You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 31st, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jonathan M. Katz, proprietor of the Racket Newsletter, author of Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, The Marines, and The Making and Breaking of America's Empire. Also on the program today, UN Security Council meets to debate the Russia-Ukraine situation. Meanwhile, the Biden administration and Congress looking at sanctions, which could be aimed at the average Russian citizen. Meanwhile, Donald Trump on the campaign trail, sort of, once again, says he'd pardon January 6th defendants, of course giving a green light to a January 6th sequel. Lobbying continues for Biden's Supreme Court pick. Consumer spending falls in December as Omicron takes its toll. New York State Democrats released their congressional districts maps, and it would mean a pickup of at least three congressional seats. Meanwhile, 36,000 Afghan refugees still lack a legal pathway to permanent status in this country. And back in Afghanistan, their economy devastated. The Iran deal talks enter its final stage. Diplomats return to their homes in Europe and the States. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is another week. It is another Monday. Emma Vigeland is here.
Hello.
Just like,
I'm just so happy.
Vibrating from the playoffs this weekend.
Even Matt watched, and he's more of a basketball head. So yeah,
it's true. I watched the Bengals defeat the Kansas City Chiefs.
That was pretty amazing.
Usually I have sympathy with the Missouri River teams, but Cincinnati, I like that.
It's just a cool story. I mean, I was saying before the show, like, these two teams couldn't be built in two different ways. The LA Rams, all glitz and glamour, mortgage their entire future for these stars, including Odell, who I'll always love. And then the Bengals were the worst team in the league 2 years ago. And they drafted Burrow. They didn't trade down. And look what it gets them. It's the most exciting playoffs in years. So
also, Tom Brady's not in it.
Yeah, which is fun.
And announced that he was retiring. Sort of announced, but it sounds like it's just he wants the timing on it because there's got to be some tie-in with a product.
I would imagine. Right? I would imagine when he launches his NFT is when he's going to be retiring. He is one of those crypto. Seems like every person I like in the NFL, I find out 2 seconds later that they're shilling crypto.
It's all
of
the
well.
NBA too. It sucks.
I mean, yeah. Look, you know, the tulips are nice if people want to. I wouldn't recommend it to people, but people need a hobby.
I know. I mean, I would collect Beanie Babies. That might be more worth your time, but to each their own if you have a ton of money.
Meanwhile, the quietest story that will be ongoing over the next, hopefully, just a couple of weeks. It should be even less than that as far as I'm concerned. Will be the Biden administration's nominee for the Supreme Court. It depends on who he nominates, I guess, on some level. But there's every reason to believe that this should be fairly smooth sailing. Fairly smooth sailing. However, it's got to happen quick. Because if you take a look at the average age of a Democratic senator, there is reason for concern. And so they need to get this person confirmed as soon as possible. Once they are confirmed, doesn't matter how long Breyer stays on the court, they are confirmed. So he can retire in June and go off and give a bunch more speeches about how wonderful our democracy is, whatever he wants to do. Get the person confirmed. And the Republicans, of course, are trying to figure out how they can say that this process is wrong or...
too close to the election.
Too close to the election, too close to the last election,
yeah.
Too close to future election, too close to primaries, Democratic primaries and congressional races. I mean, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But, of course, how can they also generate the angst that they need from their base when they know, the base does, that they have a 6-3 majority? And the reality is that the implications of this seat, unless something dramatic happens, are not going to be too great, at least for another a decade or two.
It's an investment in the future.
Yes. But that's hard to get people upset about, unless, of course, you have a go-to as the Republicans. And we're going to see this even from Susan Collins, who's ostensibly one of the more reasonable Republicans. Here she is on ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
George, I would welcome the appointment of a black female to the court. I believe that diversity benefits the Supreme Court, but the way that the president has handled this nomination has been clumsy at best. It adds to the further perception that the court is a political institution like Congress when it is not supposed to be. So I certainly am open to whomever he decides to nominate. My job as a senator is to evaluate the qualifications of that person under the advice and consent role.
You say that it's clumsy, but isn't it, as Senator Durbin pointed out, isn't it exactly what President Reagan did when he said he would appoint a woman to the Supreme Court? Isn't it exactly what President Trump did when he said he would appoint a woman to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
Actually, it isn't exactly the same. I've looked at what was done in both cases, and what President Biden did was, as a candidate, make this pledge, and that helped politicize the entire nomination process. What President Reagan said is, as one of his Supreme Court justices, he would like to appoint a woman, and he appointed a highly qualified one in Sandra Day O'Connor.
Isn't this process politicized no matter what you do? I mean, look at what happened after the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Justice Barrett pushed through in record time. One of the reasons I suppose you voted against her.
Actually, the reason I voted against...
I can't listen to this anymore. I mean, it's unbelievable. First off, I am fascinated by how thinly she's slicing this. Reagan pledged that one of his choices would be Biden supposedly saying that every choice that he's going to make is going to be a black one. Let's go back. Now, Bradley, correct me if I'm wrong. Back in 1980... the presidential elections still took place in that first Tuesday in November, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, this is from October 14th, 1980. So that would be when Ronald Reagan was still a candidate.
Mm. Thus politicizing this.
Well, let's play this clip and find out. Mm. I just wanted to make sure that I got the timeline correct here.
Polls continuing to show he runs better among men than women. Reagan took a dramatic step today to reach out for female support.
Now, I'm announcing today that one of the first Supreme Court vacancies in my administration will be filled by the most qualified woman I can possibly find, one who meets the high standards I will demand for all court appointments. It's time for a woman to sit among our highest jurists.
Reagan acknowledged that his opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment has hurt him with some women, but said today's announcement shows his commitment to equal opportunity. Today's Supreme Court announcement was a bold step for a campaign that...
That was Chris Wallace, who ended up on Fox News, incidentally.
Wow. I didn't even recognize him there.
Oh, yeah. He wound up decades later. But I guess she was saying the difference was
he wasn't politicizing
because he said one of the first instead of the first.
Even though it's in the context of me struggling with women on a campaign.
Right. Very unpolitical of Ronald Reagan. And I can't imagine, like, can you imagine anybody politicizing the idea of the Supreme Court? It's not like, do we have Donald Trump? Should we pull up one of the multiple instances where he waived a list of people that he was going to choose from? Like, literally, here's the organization. Heritage Foundation includes five heritage recommendations.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, we could see the list of candidates. Never mind, like, from what... perspective. Like, here are the specific people. It's just absurd.
But what makes this different, though, Sam?
I can only imagine.
It's just odd, right? These circumstances seem to be quite similar, except for there's one difference here, the addition of the word black.
Well, yes, and it, of course, then it makes it all like affirmative action. It's
just
that's a coincidence.
The point, that's why they're drumming up that exact... I mean, they are good at getting grassroots outrage about court appointments and about Supreme Court, which is not something that the Democrats are able to do. And what's an easy shorthand for that or a shortcut? Okay, you know, if you don't like the fact that the black person at your job got promoted ahead of you, you feel like you're more deserved, you're struggling with your employment situation, oh, you see these black people getting ahead. That's exactly what they're tapping into, and Susan Collins is no different from the rest of the Republicans.
Of course, but you also got to remember the Obama cell phone. That's the slush fund for the cell phone. And you should also know that it was a complete coincidence that there was only the two most qualified people in the country when Donald Trump became president, which just happened to be white guys in their 40s. And I guess maybe Gorsuch was in 50.
Well, how about Coney Barrett? She was super qualified, right? She must have been a judge for many, 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 many years.
Many, many days, sort of. So there it is. We're going to hear more of this as we go on. It'll be interesting. Was it Wicker that came out and said this is an affirmative action pick? That way you get
Clarence
both
Thomas,
flavors.
You get
both flavors of the Republican Party. The ones who will say it explicitly and the ones who will say it, politely. We're going to take we'll be back in just a moment with Jonathan M. Katz. He's the proprietor of the Racket Newsletter, author of Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, The Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire. But first, as you know, we're in a new year. No better way to kick off 2022 than making sure you're feeling like your best self. And that includes staying hydrated with Liquid IV. I've told you this many times before. One stick of Liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates you faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, Liquid IV has incredible hydration flavors like watermelon, which happens to be one of my favorite, lemon lime, strawberry, which I know you like.
I do.
Pina colada, which also happens to be one of my favorite. Right now, I am enjoying the tangerine, which has a little bit of an immunity boost. I guess they put more vitamins.
And let's, but for everybody out there, if you are drinking, that's the best. That's my usage sometimes for it. If I'm had a little bit too much to drink that night, it'll be incredibly effective for preventing a hangover.
Liquid IV contains five essential vitamins: B3, B5, B6, B12. And vitamin C. I think it's the Bs that actually help you with that. With Liquid IV, you get three times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. And Liquid IV is made with premium ingredients, non-GMO, free from gluten, dairy, and soy. Science of cellular transport technology is what makes Liquid IV so effective. It's designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other key ingredients into the bloodstream. Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. The company's donated over 19 million servings globally. I'm going to be going on a trip in February. And so when I get on a plane, or I'm about to, and after. Keep yourself hydrated. It's going to be the first time on a plane for a couple of years for me. We'll see. But also, like I say, like Emma said, something if you're overindulging, good to have. For me, it's just my daily now regimen. Stay hydrated. I drink a ton of liquid IV during our shows. Sometimes it's this one, and the other one I go to is the, what is it, the matcha ginger. And it's got a little bit of an energy boost. So there you go. Check it out. Grab Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco. You can get 25% off, though, when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MAJORITYREP. MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you use promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. Experience better hydration today. liquidiv.com. Promo code MAJORITYREP. Check it out. They got a bunch of different flavors, actually, these days, so you should check that out. Meanwhile, everybody wants a little extra time. I certainly do. And a little extra money. Well, if you have many things to mail, you're spending a lot of time going to the post office, and you can save that time by sitting in your home or your office and ship online at stamps.com. It's the place where you get the services of the post office and UPS all in one place. All you got to do, use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send it. And once your mail is ready, you just schedule a pickup or you just drop it off. That's right. What time is it? It's 2 a.m. I think it's time for me to send out some of these DVDs. What time is it? It's 4 a.m. I'm going to print out. I mean, I don't know why you're doing it at that time, but...
Why are you sending a bunch of DVDs?
Well, I, back when the show started, I sent a bunch of DVDs to
stamps.com.
But I'm just... I guess people aren't doing that anymore.
Yeah.
I'm old.
Just aging yourself.
I guess that's true. I guess, sending NFTs. With stamps.com, you also you get discounts up to 40% off post office rates and up to 62% off of UPS shipping rates. It's no wonder why nearly 1 million small businesses already use stamps.com. Folks, this is super easy. If you have any type of small business or you find out yourself, sending a lot of packages or mail, nothing could be easier than printing out your own postage. So you can stop wasting your time leaving your office or your home. Don't wait in line. Go to stamps.com instead. There's no risk. And with my promo code MAJORITYREPORT, you get a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, type in MAJORITYREPORT. That's stamps.com, promo code MAJORITYREPORT. Stamps.com, never leave your office or your home again. I don't know.
That sounds nice to me.
Honestly, it's freezing cold out.
I didn't leave my apartment all weekend. I would have used stamps. I need to use stamps.com.
Lastly, tell you that 90% of employers plan to make enhancing the employee experience a top priority in 2022. Makes sense. Certainly try it. Get the water cooler. That helped. A happy workplace is the key to attracting and keeping great employees. We did that around here with the water cooler.
I was threatening to quit.
Yeah, and you're like, where's the free water? Well, there it is.
Yeah.
It's right there. We got a ton of it. We just got to figure out how to schedule it now because we got a lot of backlog. But if we ever get locked up in here. But the bottom line is if you need to add more employees to your team, ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's matching technology helps you find the right people for your roles fast. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. Then what it does is it proactively presents these candidates to you. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply for your job. And that, of course, encourages them to apply faster. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. I know this to be the case because that is how we got Brendan, still with us, still does a little bit of work for the show. Then We got Bradley through Brendan. So really,
it's the transitive property.
Exactly. But ZipRecruiter was, they must have been advertising with us for a while. So I gave it a try, and it was incredibly effective. I interviewed a bunch of people. They have a great interface so you can organize them. And ZipRecruiter sort of reached out and got Brendan, sort of found Brendan where he was and had him apply. Worked out very well for us. Find the right employees for your workplace with ZipRecruiter. You can try it for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. And a good time to look for employees, frankly, is when you don't need them. You build a little bit of a bank, get a sense of who's out there and what they can do. So check it out. All right. Want to welcome to the program Jonathan M. Katz. He's the proprietor of the Racket newsletter, author of Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, The Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire. Do we have him? Jonathan, hey. Jonathan, welcome to the show. I'm here with Emma Veglin.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing great. How about
doing
you?
Doing great. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for being. Thank you for being here in my house.
Yes. Well, glad to be here. So I have had a vague awareness of Smedley Butler probably now almost 18 years. My old co-host at the Majority Report was sort of obsessed with Smedley Butler and his proclamations. War was a racket, particularly was something we would talk about as we, had just entered into a war with Iraq. And so I just found his life story fascinating. And when we were talking before the show, I said, like, this guy's sort of like, he's sort of like the Forrest Gump of U.S. imperialism. And I don't want to say that. And then I read an interview where you brought that up. So I felt vindicated. But yeah, let's just start before we go through. And it's a great way to learn about so much of what we deal with now, 115 years later, what the sort of the origin stories of our relationship with these countries is today in terms of imperialism. But give us just a broad overview of Smedley Butler first, and then we'll go into some of the specifics.
Yeah, so Smedley Butler was, in short, he was a Marine. He was a lot of things. He was a Quaker from Philadelphia. He lied about his age at 16 to join the Marine Corps in 1898. We were at war in Cuba with the Spanish Empire. And from there, he was Forrest Gump, like you said. I mean, he was in every U.S. invasion, occupation, intervention, overseas war from basically 1898 until the eve of the Second World War. He retired a major general, which was the highest rank available to Marines at the time. He was a celebrity. He was beloved by his Marines. He was twice the recipient of the Medal of Honor, which is a very big deal. But then he spent the last 10 years of his life as an anti-war, anti-imperialist activist who, among other things, blew the whistle on a alleged fascist coup to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt in 1934.
I mean, one of the things I love about this book is it's a great way for folks to get an overview of our of this era when it feels like, we were also talking like, what you would, sort of like the sequel to Manifest Destiny. It's like we ran out of territory to colonize in this country. And so we said, we started to look to other places. Is that basically the story of at least that first 20 years of the 20th century?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one way to tell it. I mean, I talk in the book about Frederick Jackson's frontier thesis, which basically, in the 1890s, the superintendent of the U.S. Census declared that the frontier was for all intents and purposes closed. And At that moment, there was all this turmoil going on in the United States. There was a big economic depression in 1893, and a lot of elites were afraid. You know, they saw socialism coming, they saw anarchism coming, and they were afraid that, you know, the America that they knew was going to change. And Turner offered this idea that basically he called it free land. But basically through, you know, the conquest and ethnic cleansing of native lands in the western part of North America, that, you know, this had created the American character, by which he meant essentially the white American character. And based on that idea, these new opportunities presented themselves with essentially this war against the Spanish Empire and the dissolution of the Spanish Empire. And you know, there were other thinkers at the time who were envisioning a you know, huge American Navy, you know, American merchant fleets, you know, getting rich, you know, selling things to China. And all of these ideas kind of came together at once. And it turned us from essentially, you know, a continental empire into a global empire.
So Butler's first foray is into the Spanish-American war, which is essentially for Cuba. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just walk us through that. I mean, this is, you know, there was some sense, I think, by the Cubans who were trying to become independent, maybe a strong sense, certainly as articulated by Martí, who was, I think the Cubans perceive him as like we do George Washington on some level, that it was going to be a problem because the United States was going to come and they weren't going to leave. And to some extent, that was 100% true.
Yeah. I mean, there were Cuban exiles at the time, sort of, you know, Cuban Ahmed Chalabis of like the late 19th century who wanted the United States to get involved. So they had been at war. The Cubans had been fighting for their independence for basically 30 years at that point. They'd actually fought a war, lost it, fought another war, lost it. And then Martí comes in 1895 and starts another war. And, you know, each time they had been making more progress and they were getting very close to achieving their independence on their own. Some Cuban exiles wanted the Americans to get involved. And so they, you know, were trying to recruit the jingos, as they were known, you know, Teddy Roosevelt and, you know, American capitalists from the Northeast. And José Martí was in the United States. He was like going around to like Cuban exile communities and trying to raise money. And he bought guns and put fighters on a boat in Florida. And they were interdicted at sea, actually, by the Coast Guard. It's a whole story. But Martí, as you say, like he was very worried. And he warned a friend of his in Mexico that they needed to win their independence fast. Because if they didn't, the United States was going to get involved. And then, as you said, not only was he warning that the United States would never leave Cuba, but that this would be the beginning of a conquest of Latin America, which, you know, in some sense continues to this day. Martí didn't live to see it. He died in his very first battle, but he warned it.
What was Smedley Butler's perspective at that time, and what role did he play in that specific conflict?
Yeah, so Butler was, I mean, he was a teenager. Like he was a rich kid on the main line in Philadelphia. And he was reading the newspapers and he was, you know, caught up sort of in the war hysteria that everybody else was. So, you know, some people, I'm sure people, you know, remember the Maine, right? So the USS Maine goes to protect U.S. interests in the middle of this essentially civil war or war of independence between the Cubans and their Spanish colonizers. It blows up. Nobody still exactly knows why. The U.S. government actually isn't the one who blames the Spanish. It's really the media. It's kind of, you know, popular hysteria that blames the Spanish government for having done this. And Butler, he's 16, you know, like a lot of 16-year-olds, like 16-year-olds after 9/11. They got caught up in the patriotic fervor and he wanted to suit up. He wanted to join up. He actually goes to the army first. They reject him because he's a kid. But the Marines are just ramping up for their first overseas war. The Marines up to that point had basically been, you know, sort of a rump force of the Navy. They were kind of glorified ship guards. And as the army is gearing itself up to stop fighting the wars against the native peoples in North America and invade Cuba, while they're trying to figure out how to get people on boats, the Marines are the one branch that already knows how to do this, and they're willing to take anyone they can get, even a scrawny 16-year-old who had never fired a gun before, as far as I can tell, from a Quaker from Philly.
And we should say, ultimately, what comes out of that is not only a sort of ongoing client state for the next 50 years or so in Cuba, but the Platt Amendment. Just tell us what the Platt Amendment is, and from then we should also say Guantanamo is born.
Exactly. So the short answer is, I feel like we're doing the AP high school history class.
Well, I mean, that, honestly, yeah. I mean, I think that's like
Totally.
That is the thing that I really appreciate about the book is that it gives a sort of it's like a tour of the imperialism of that day.
I guess I'm being self-conscious. I want to make sure I'm not boring people at home by talking about.
Oh, no. What have you here?
So basically, the decision to go to war, there's actually a fight in Congress between essentially two groups of racist people. So there's the expansionists, you know, the Teddy Roosevelt camp, that they just want to conquer Cuba. And then there are the isolationists who at that point are, for the most part, kind of neo-Confederates. Some of them were actual members of the Confederate Army themselves. And they're worried about conquering Cuba and then getting a bunch of non-white Catholic, you know, Spanish speakers into the United States. And again, like, this is, you know, sort of a theme of this moment, but they're kind of, I mean, these are architects of Jim Crow, and they're worried about changing the ethnic makeup and racial balance of the United States. And so as a compromise in the declaration of war, there's an amendment called the Teller Amendment, sponsored by a senator, that says we are going to go to war here, but we are prohibiting ourselves from conquering the island of Cuba. But as this war ends, we now have a bunch of troops in Cuba, and as you say, we're setting up a client state, and the compromise to the compromise is another amendment by, you know, a powerful senator named Orville Platt, stuffed into an appropriations bill that says, okay, we're not conquering you as a colony, but you have to do what we say. You know, we get final say over decisions of your government. We can, you know, invade anytime we feel like it, and we do. And we get to keep any land as we see fit for naval bases, for you know, what were known at the time as coaling stations. And the big one was the one that Smedley Butler arrives at. It's the first place that the Americans land in 1898. The Marines take the beachhead. Smedley Butler is in basic training basically at that point, but he comes a couple weeks later. It's Guantanamo Bay, and it's the Platt Amendment. Long story short, there's actually sort of a little wrinkle in the mid 20th century because we sort of substitute another law for it, but it's essentially the same law. It's that amendment. It's that concept that makes the United States Cuba stays the nominal landlord, but the United States becomes the renter in perpetuity, and we can't be kicked out. We're sort of a super renter because it's up to us if we break the lease. And that's why we still have Guantanamo Bay. And it's that weird legal, you know, weirdness that, because like it's Cuban land, but they can't kick us out and the Americans run it. That's this sort of neither fish nor fowl status that the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, takes advantage of after 9/11 to create the Forever Prison, which is still operating there. And it's a place where we can at least tell ourselves that international law and U.S. law and Cuban law, there's no law there, like no law applies. And that's what it enables us to do, the torture and the indefinite detention and you know, just violate all the constitutional principles that we violate in creating the Guantanamo prison camp.
And if folks want to understand sort of the so-called isolationist argument in that instance, that really is just isolationist insofar as like we don't want to conquer that. We don't want them to be a territory. You almost see the same thing playing out when it was a question of Afghan refugees coming into this country, a couple of months ago, when you had people complaining that we were going to have to absorb all these Afghan refugees from the war, and we're, you know,
yeah. I mean, one of the
aware that they're there, right?
One of the themes that runs through all of these wars up to the present day, and one of the reasons why this period is so interesting to me is because the wars in Butler's day, the imperial wars, are just they are very much of a piece with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and Syria and all these other forever wars that are going on, and the same concepts that we sort of cook up then in these fights that are happening then, these compromises still carry through to the present day, which is basically like, we want their resources, we want their stuff. We want to be able to do whatever we please without any accountability, with just total impunity, but we don't want them. They should stay there. And then once we're done with them, and we're seeing this in Afghanistan now, you know, that's it. Sorry, you're on your own. Good luck.
So you follow Butler to from Guantanamo, then to the Philippines, then into the Boxer War, back to the Philippines, into Central America, Nicaragua, Panama, and in Mexico, in Veracruz, and Haiti. Give us which one of those conflicts, or which couple of those conflicts, do you think is the most relevant in terms of Butler's, you know, perspective on what they were doing changing?
That's an interesting question. So, I mean, I would say Nicaragua is the first place that I see evidence of him sort of taking a look around and starting to question the motives of the people who were sending him into war. So Nicaragua, he goes three times. He's based in the Panama Canal Zone, which he and the Marines had also helped conquer as sort of an American colony, as we, help force the secession of Panama from Colombia for purposes of building the Panama Canal. But he's doing these sorties up from the canal zone to Nicaragua. And a couple of things are happening at that moment. The one is on a political level. America is, we're moving into, you know, what's known as dollar diplomacy, I was talking about like this compromise over the not annexing Cuba. That didn't apply in the Philippines. So we just full out colonized the Philippines. We take it. It's a wholly owned colony for 50 years. It's a very expensive and very costly and very bloody war. And the Taft administration, which has now taken power in the States, is looking for other ways to do things, you know, on the cheap, on the sly, you know, a little out, because there's also a backlash to the Philippine-American War, much as there's a backlash to the Iraq War in our own day. And Nicaragua is offering them an opportunity to do things differently. So instead of declaring war, instead of colonizing Nicaragua, the U.S. government basically puts out a tender to some banks to set up a National Bank of Nicaragua and take over the country's finances. And by doing that, we're going to control Nicaragua. We're going to install a puppet president who's actually the accountant for an American mining firm. And we're going to do that with the muscle of the Marines. So this is known as dollar diplomacy. So that's one thing that's changing. The other thing that's changing on a personal level for Smedley Butler is that he's now a major, which gives him a lot more latitude to make his own decisions about where he goes, who he talks to. You know, he decides when he gets off the boat himself and sort of, you know, goes on this sightseeing tour of Nicaragua. And he's able to talk to members of the Nicaraguan elite. He's able to meet all these, you know, American capitalists, all these, you know, wildcat financiers, as he calls them, who've come down, you know, looking for a payday. And he's able to see what's going on. And it's sort of at that moment when he starts saying things like, you know, well, we're only down here because Brown Brothers Bank, you know, has some money down here. And I don't know, you know, like, you know, whose bright idea was this anyway? It doesn't keep him from doing anything. It doesn't keep him from, he kills a lot of people, and he makes decisions that, you know, continue, you know, affecting Nicaraguans to this day. But that's a moment when I think that's a moment when things start changing for him.
Okay, so he's gone through Philippine U.S. war at that point, which was essentially to open up a commercial trading outpost for Asia, for the United States. Does he like retroactively reassess that war once he's in a position in Nicaragua to get a sense of what the dynamics were? And now he's getting a chance to look behind the curtain. Is he reassessing what he had seen in front of the curtain in the Philippines based upon what he had seen behind the curtain in Nicaragua?
It takes time. It takes more time than that for him. He ultimately does. I mean, he ultimately, you know, in the 1930s calls for the United States to give the Philippines their independence. For two reasons. One, because he thinks that, you know, they deserve it. And the other is because he sees that a war is coming with Japan over the Philippines, over America's colonies in the Pacific, including Hawaii, including Guam. But the Philippines is the big prize. I mean, you know, today there are 150 million people in the Philippines. It's a huge expanse of land and, you know, thousands of islands. But while he's in Nicaragua, he's not yet thinking that globally. I mean, so from Nicaragua, he then, you know, as you noted, he invades Mexico at the behest of American oil companies. He goes on a spy run in Mexico investigating, you know, regime change there. And he then goes to Haiti, which is really where that's kind of the apotheosis of his career. And it's where I encountered him first, right? Cause I was the Associated Press correspondent in Haiti, for 3.5 years. I was there during the earthquake in 2010. And that was kind of how I came to his story, because in Haiti, he's known as the devil. He's known as in Creole, they call him méchant. Like, he's the most evil of the Marines. So he's starting to put two and two together, but he's not quite there yet. And he talks about that in later on in the 1930s, when he starts doing this anti-war writing, when he writes War is a Racket, and he writes this series of articles. It's actually sometimes confused for War is a Racket, in a socialist magazine called Common Sense. He talks about how, you know, I didn't have an original thought in my head, you know, the whole time I was in the Marine Corps. There's a part of Gangsters of my book where I talk about the imperial history of zombies, which we can get into if you want, but you know, the zombies are introduced into American culture because of the U.S. occupation of Haiti, and really, you know, in large part because of the work of Smedley Butler. And I kind of like, there's kind of a comparison to be made there between sort of, you know, the way that the Nigerian band leader Fela Kuti, you know, the way he sees zombies as sort of being like mindless drones, and drone warfare, right? And Butler kind of retroactively sees himself like that. I think maybe he's being a little too convenient there with his excuses. I think he was making decisions for himself and deciding, you know, he was deciding who to kill and who not to kill, what hills to climb up, and, you know, what hills not to charge up. But it isn't instantaneous like that, because he's, you know, honestly, like, he still has a lot to gain personally from being a Marine. I mean, it's still core to his identity. He's gaining fame. He's you know, winning the acclaim and the approval of his fellow Marines and ultimately the American public. I wish that I could say that, you know, he looks around and he's like, oh, you know, I'm in Nicaragua. One of the things that he does is he bivouacs half of his Marines in the National Bank of Nicaragua, which is chartered in Connecticut. And this is like one of the things where he's like, I think we're not actually here for democracy. I think we're here for this bank that I'm literally housing my Marines inside. I wish I could say that he then is like, you know, oh, I'm going to go back and, you know, work for the decolonization of the Philippines immediately. But no, it takes more time than that. He's part of the structure. And that's a thing that continues for a couple decades more.
And this history of him being, you know, pretty vicious throughout these occupations, I guess, and these wars and these invasions is pretty stunning. There was one quote that I'd like you to just expand on by a mayor in a Philippines town. I think it was Balogia. I think
Balangiga.
Balangiga. When you look back on that era, you need to remember and forget at the same time. What does that mean?
Yeah. So as you know, like I go to Balangiga. I go to all the places essentially that Butler and the Marines invaded to sort of figure out what the memory of this time is. And Balangiga is a horrendous moment in American history that not a lot of Americans know about. So the Marines, Butler's actually not with these Marines because he would have been with them, but he contracts typhoid in China, basically putting down the Boxer Rebellion, which is a popular anti-foreign rebellion just before this. But his mentor, Littleton Waller, who is, you know, just an outright white supremacist. So in this town of Balangiga, there is a massacre of occupying American soldiers. And in revenge, I think 48 of them are killed, along with, you know, 20-some insurgents from Balangiga. And it's on the island of Samar, so like other Samaranians. And in revenge for this killing, the American general, a guy named Jake Smith, Howland Jake Smith, who has cut his teeth in the, you know, the so-called Indian Wars in North America, orders the Marines in to basically commit essentially a genocide against the people of Samar and to turn the island of Samar, in his words, into a howling wilderness. And when I go to Balangiga, I'm not sure like what people are going to remember there, like, you know, what kind of signs of memory there are going to be. And I get to town and there is the craziest monument that I've ever seen. It is basically like a life-size diorama, like a group of statues of American soldiers at their breakfast table as the Balangiga Non insurgents are storming their mess tent with machetes to commit this massacre. And, you know, in Balangiga, one of the big ways in which this massacre is remembered, the revenge massacre, is that when the Americans come and massacre them in revenge, we take these church bells and we take them back to the United States. And as of when I was in Balangiga in 2017, they had not yet been returned. And so, as you say, so I sit down with the mayor of this town. And I'm like, and I'm asking sort of, you know, like, so how do you remember these things? Like, you know, clearly this is a big deal. You have this statue of the massacre, in the middle of your town. You have pictures of the bells, the Balangiga bells, like on your wall office. There's like a yearly like marathon. There's this pageant that I see a video of where they reenact all of these things, including the massacre of the Americans and then the revenge massacre of the people in Balangiga. And then he's talking to me about his life, and he has a brother who's a Marine who's in the United States Marines. He has other siblings who are like living in the United States. And I'm asking him, you know, so I'm an American, right? Like I've come to your town. I'm an inheritor of this legacy of the people who just slaughtered your people and were ordered to kill all males over the age of 10. Anybody, you know, capable of carrying a rifle was the instruction. I was like, well, how do you deal with that? Like, how do you deal with having, you know, a sibling in the Marines, you know, siblings in the United States? And he was like, well, I have to forget. Like, you know, you have to move on. And I was like, but you also said that it's important to remember, like, you have this statue, you do this pageant every year. Like, it's almost as if you have to remember and forget at the same time. And without hesitation, he just says, yes. And I think that, you know, I think that that is a thing that it pervades the book. It exists in a lot of places that I go, because these relationships between the places that we colonize, the places that we still sort of, you know, to a certain extent, de facto colonize in some cases, it's really complicated, because people who live in these places, they look to America as a land of wealth, as, you know, to some extent, a land of opportunity. They have their own problems at home. I mean, in the Philippines, you have Duterte, who's essentially, you know, kind of a dictator. He's certainly an authoritarian. You know, while I'm there, he's undertaking this, you know, process of, you know, this, you know, kind of, I don't want to call it a genocide, but it's just mass extrajudicial killing of the poor under the pretense of a so-called war on drugs. You know, they're seeing Duterte, like, you know, move their country closer to the authoritarian regime in China. And, you know, there's memory of the United States coming in at the end of this war that we helped cause through this imperial rivalry with Japan. But we come in sort of and act as liberators, kill a lot of people, but act as liberators from the Japanese, who they also remember as being, you know, a horrible, murderous imperial power. And the only way that they can reconcile themselves with, you know, feeling any kind of affinity or any kind of closeness to the United States is by sort of putting these things in the past. But they also can't put them in the past. They don't want to put them in the past, because they also, first of all, they happened. Second of all, like, you know, these stories have been passed down to them. And third of all, they acquire some kind of meaning from this, right? They encounter a kind of communal feeling within themselves by remembering these atrocities in their past, just as you know, anybody remembers, you know, gets a feeling of themselves by remembering the ways in which their people have been wronged in the past. And so it's the process of remembering and forgetting at the same time. I mean, I think it is, you know, Franz Fanon writes about this. A lot of writers of, you know, who talk about the colonial experience talk about this. But there's kind of a double consciousness that has to operate in one's head at the same time, where you're sort of, you know, you're remembering these horrors and you're also forgetting them to allow yourself to move on. It's a really, really tricky process. And I saw it everywhere. I saw it in place after place after place that I went.
It seems much easier for the Americans, because all we've done is forgotten.
Yes.
Like all we do is, I mean, I mean, there's so much more in terms of, like, you know, our involvement in these countries that I think, you know, I want to encourage people to read. But let's jump up to the other sort of, like, I guess, a famous aspect of Smedley Butler's life that we've also completely, for the most part, you know, willfully forgotten, it seems to me. And I think, again, so much of this, so much of what we've forgotten that Smedley Butler sort of represented, both sort of like pre his awareness of how American imperialism was functioning and what role he played in it, and post, is because there was a lot of, like, entrenched oligarchic, if you want to say, interests who really didn't want this history to be exposed, because to a certain extent it allows for the maintenance of this same sort of operations. And I'm in this instance, I'm specifically talking about Butler comes back. He begins to become disenchanted. And before he starts getting very vocal about this, right? Because, you know, had this gone down 5 years later or so, well, I guess I want to get a sense from you in terms of, like, what was the catalyst. But he's approached in 1933. He's not public yet, right? At this point, with his disillusionment, right?
No. I mean, no. Yeah, he's been court-martialed for insulting Benito Mussolini. He's going on kind of a speaking tours where he's kind of scandalizing audiences by talking about some of the things that he's done. But no, he's not yet. War is a Racket is not written yet. He's not out with really like the full blown criticism of the United States and of U.S. foreign policy.
So he's approached by this guy, Gerald McGuire, who is representing, I don't know if it's specifically the Liberty League or just like sort of a crew of capitalists who are very worried about FDR's New Deal, that it's too socialistic, that they're giving away the farm, essentially. Is he approached because he had been court-martialed? Like, let's find a guy who we think is aligned to us, but has been sort of unfairly treated by, you know, whatever in some way. I mean, is that what the theory was?
That's an interesting piece of it, I think. It's hard to say because, you know, Jerry Maguire dies very soon after. So he never says exactly what he was thinking. But I think so. It's a couple of things. One is that what Maguire is approaching him to do is to, you know, head up a coup, to basically, you know, lead an armed mob into Washington, D.C., up Pennsylvania Avenue to intimidate Franklin Roosevelt into either resigning or delegating all his powers to a cabinet secretary. And they're doing this for the purpose of, overturning the New Deal, which they know is popular and isn't going to lose at the ballot box. And I think that there are a couple of things that I think we can point to as being reasons why Butler might have been approached. One is that Butler had a long track record of overthrowing governments using armed force. Right. So, in Haiti, for instance, where he was for several years, he dissolves a parliament at gunpoint for the purpose of forcing through a constitution that's going to allow Americans to own land in Haiti and have like American corporations make money there. He's also overthrown governments in Nicaragua. His Marines, are responsible for the rise of Somoza, the Nicaraguan dictator, Rafael Trujillo, who's the dictator in the Dominican Republic, etc. And Jerry Maguire's boss, a guy named Grayson M.P. Murphy, and this is something that I found in my research, he was a former military intelligence official who had been all over the world. He was in the Philippines. He was in Panama during the secession plot, which Sullivan and Cromwell, the big imperialist law firm, which still exists, which some people may know because of the involvement of John Foster and Alan Dulles, right? Were Sullivan and Cromwell partners with United Fruit. They helped overthrow Jacobo Arbenz, the president of Guatemala in 1954. So Butler has this sort of track record of overthrowing governments. But as you note, he's a maverick. I mean, he's been court-martialed for insulting Benito Mussolini in 1931. In 1932, there's this episode called the Bonus March, where basically a bunch of veterans of the First World War come to Washington to demand federal benefits that they had been promised. They stage essentially kind of like, Occupy Washington 1932. And the establishment kind of lines up against them. They see them as, degenerates. Douglas MacArthur accuses them as being, communists, trying to hatch a communist.
We should say, like, there's amazing photographs of like all the tents pitched in, I think it's the Washington the monument. What do you call it?
The mall.
The mall.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty impressive. But yeah.
And actually, this ends up with Douglas MacArthur and the army burning the camp to the ground. George Patton, who's a major at that time, a cavalry officer, leads a cavalry charge into this camp. But in the middle of this demonstration, this month-long demonstration, 9 days actually before the army invades the camp, Butler goes and he sides with the bonus marchers. He gives them this rousing speech where he, you know, says, this is the greatest example of, Americanism that I've ever saw. Stand your ground. He said, don't back up, because as soon as you back up, he's giving great protesting advice. Actually, he's saying as soon as you break your camp, all of this evaporates into thin air and nobody's going to even remember that you were here. So stay here until you get what you want. And I think that, to a certain extent, the business plotters, Jerry Maguire, Grayson Murphy, his boss, they miscalculate badly and they get the politics completely wrong. They don't have enough class analysis. They don't understand that Butler is there fighting on behalf of, the poor, impoverished, working veteran who's suffering, from the Great Depression. All they see is this guy who's overthrown governments overseas, this guy who missed out on becoming commandant of the Marine Corps and has, a chip on his shoulder. And this guy who is on these newsreels, giving this rousing speech to some of the exact veterans who they want to come to Washington to, participate in this coup. And they love him. They're hanging on every word. He's old Gimlet Eye. He's this beloved general.
They being anti-establishment as exactly. Opposed to having an ideology. Exactly. And assume if he's anti-establishment, he'd be willing to help us stage a coup. He certainly has the skill set to stage a coup against FDR. It's just they didn't realize that he was more ideologically sympathetic with what FDR was doing than they had assumed. Well, and I just wanted to take it into the hearings. There were hearings about this. This is not like an apocryphal story. There was hearings, there was testimony, and on some level, it was buried. There's a quality to this that is there was a lot of people who didn't want there to be a broad sort of understanding that there was I don't know what you would call it, a capitalist coup attempt, essentially.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think that them missing the politics is classic fascism, because we see it today on the fascist right in America. It's this idea that it's that we're elites, but we're anti-establishment. We're anti-establishment elites. We're anti-us elites. It's this thing that it comes right out of sort of the foundations of fascism in Italy, as sort of this thing that kind of, Mussolini kind of grows out of this, socialist movement. But he's but we're going to do socialism, but without class. We're going to do socialism, but the rich keep their money, and we'll just keep. The important thing is violence and regimentedness, it's hard to say, because as you say, this gets buried really by Congress. We don't know exactly, how many people were involved in it beyond Jerry Maguire, this bond salesman, member of the American Legion who comes to recruit Butler, and almost certainly his boss, Grayson Murphy. Maguire tells Butler, you alluded earlier to this thing, the Liberty League. So Maguire tells Butler that there's going to be this group of businessmen who are going to kind of come out, in a couple of weeks from when they're talking in August 1934, to back this thing financially, that they're going to sort of be, he calls them the villagers in the opera. And Butler, immediately pegs this as the Liberty League, which is a group of businessmen. It's founded by the DuPonts, Irene DuPont, of the DuPont Corporation, Alfred P. Sloan of General Motors, Phillips Oil, Sun Oil, the McCann Erickson ad agency, like all these guys.
J.P. Morgan involved in this as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And Grayson Murphy, who is McGuire's boss, is the treasurer of the Liberty League, which is one of the things that gives this even more credence. And the thing that we know is that the Liberty Leaguers, like, they love fascism. I mean, Thomas Lamont, who is the head of J.P. Morgan at that time, along with J.P. Morgan Jr., Lamont describes himself as something of a missionary for Mussolini. And he makes J.P. Morgan sort of, you know, like the official overseas bank of the Italian fascists. It is certainly highly plausible. Look, for these guys at this moment, it's 1934. Liberal democracy, has been horribly discredited, first by the previous World War and second by the Depression. And they're kind of looking around and they're like, look, the only ways forward are, the world is either going to go communist red or fascist black. And we definitely don't want communism because that's going to hurt us as rich people. So let's go with fascism. And, it makes perfect sense that they would, recruit Butler. And I'm kind of droning on, but there's an even closer parallel in France in February 1934, where there's this sort of riot of far right and fascist groups that storm the French Parliament. It's the closest historical antecedent to what happened on January 6th, which we can go into if you want. But, and McGuire goes to Paris. He meets with one of the leading fascist groups that took part in this riot and then comes to Butler and says, this is the group that we're going.
Here's the model.
Exactly.
Here's the model.
And they go to Congress and Congress does a very cursory investigation. But they don't follow through. And I think that, part of the reason they don't follow through is because it would require, holding some very powerful, very rich Americans accountable. And Congress then as now has an allergy to that.
Somebody stepped in. I mean, somebody must have stepped in at that point and said, like, this, this investigation's gone on far enough. You have your couple of one of the stories I love out of this, too, is that there was some sense that Prescott Bush, this is George Herbert Walker's Bush's dad, was somehow involved in this. But it turns out that he was so aligned with the Nazis at that point that he was just too officially fascist to take part in this fascist attack.
There was some confusion in the aughts. There was like a BBC documentary, and then there was like a blog post written off of it. It sort of misunderstood what they were saying in the documentary. What it was this committee that investigates the business plot. It's a committee headed by John W. McCormack, who ends up becoming Speaker of the House, and Samuel Dickstein, two Democrats, and they're investigating all kinds of fascist involvement. Their remit is to sort of investigate all forms of Nazi propaganda and attempts at fascist infiltration in the United States, as well as some communist infiltration. It's HUAC, actually. It's the predecessor to the House Un-American Activities Committee. And they were investigating another thing that involved Prescott Bush's bank, which, by the way, was Brown Brothers, at that point, Brown Brothers Harriman. So the same bank that Butler was basically fighting on their behalf to overthrow democracy in Nicaragua in the 1930s, Brown Brothers is partnering with the actual living, German, national socialist, workers' party. So he was the subject of a different investigation by the same committee. But as far as I can tell, he was never involved in this particular plot. This plot was, totally homegrown and was sort of rejecting. They thought that sort of Nazi clicking heel fascism, it wasn't our style. It wasn't our aesthetic. Even they thought that even Mussolini's black shirts you know, weren't the sort of thing that Americans were going to get involved with. They were looking to France because France was an established old democracy that was a lot more like the United States. And, you know, there were fascist currents, there were fascist uprisings in France, some of which, you know, end up sort of taking power once the Nazis invade in the form of the Vichy government. And you know, the business plotters, however many of them there were, they thought, and probably rightly, that the same thing could happen in the United States. Fascism's possible anywhere. You just have to find the right aesthetic to appeal to the right number of masses in the body politic.
But we're just about out of time. I just want to ask you this last question, and maybe sort of like, I've seen it always referred to as the business plot. Mm-hmm. But like, why? Like, what do you think is behind that? Because on some level, that term is just so generic that it really sort of obscures what's going on there. Because this wasn't business that was doing this, right? These were a far more specific set of interests. And I'm just curious as to like, what do you, having spent so much time with the history of this, like where did that moniker come from? Was that part of making it, you know, something that we would lose consciousness of in the context of our country?
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I actually don't know when that term, originated. I've seen it also referred to as the Wall Street Putsch. I've heard some people refer to it as the banker's plot, which also is sort of generic. I actually, that's a good, that's another thing. I mean, there are a lot, you know, I spent 5 years writing this book. It's been 7 years in the making. And I went down every single rabbit hole that I could think of, but there are still other rabbit holes out there. And that's a good one. I will look into that, and maybe I'll do another article about it.
Well, it's a really important story, and Smedley Butler is a great sort of, a tentpole or, I'm not sure, a clothesline or, you know, just a host, I guess, of U.S. imperialism. And much of this, I mean, today, I just did this one quote that really just stuck out for me was, I helped make Mexico, especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. That's ultimately Citibank.
That's Citibank. Yep.
And I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Baking House of Brown Brothers in 1909-1912, Prescott Bush. I mean, it really does give a great historical foundation for much of what we see today. Jonathan Katz, the book is Gangsters of Capitalism, Smedley Butler, The Marines and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. It's great.
All right. Going to head into the fun half of the program. It's coming up in just a moment.
Just looking at you.
That really is, it's a great way to be introduced, I think, to involvement, our imperialism, and specifically, you know, from that era, which was sort of, you could also argue that the template is formed in this country as we push the indigenous people out and kill them and take over their land. But in terms of like the first time where we start to face this sort of like imperialism outwards, this is that era.
And it's also just like a real gut check for, there's a lot of fanciful notions about the United States being above colonialism as opposed to like the old powers of France and Great Britain. I mean, there are like, that's kind of how some people who look at, who are American exceptionalists perceive themselves, but it's just a reality check in that way.
Yeah, we just got into the game a little later. That's all. We were more innovative.
Yeah.
I mean, the Monroe Doctrine. Exactly. This is all us. Stay out of it, guys.
Folks, a week or so ago, I did a podcast with Greg from Oklahoma on the Green Corn Rebellion show. We've been working on trying to get me on for quite some time, ages and ages. It takes me a long time. But check it out. I think we got the link, right, on YouTube to the Green Corn Rebellion show, Greg from Oklahoma. He's also running for state senate, so worth checking out.
I was on that last fall.
There you go.
We're trying to find a time. I'm going to go on soon.
It was fun. Very fun to do. So check that out. Also, don't forget, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you support the free show, and you get the fun half. So check that out. And still some tickets left to the Majority Live, the big live show, which is now 3 months minus a day from the not anniversary of January 6th, because it's actually on May 15th in Boston, mm-hmm, at the Wilbur Theater. I know that's maybe probably a little convoluted.
No, that was easy to follow.
Yes, of course. MajorityLive.com. You get your tickets there. Check that out. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lackian Media Universe?
Yeah, David and I, for Left Reckoning patrons, patreon.com/Left Reckoning, talked to Kevin Bird. He's a radical scientist focused on evolution, plant genome stuff, I believe. But we talk about this new book, The Genetic Lottery, that purports to say actually social justice warriors should take a closer look at genetic science, and their PC-ness is causing them to overlook important stuff. And it turns out that that's not actually true.
Really?
And it's the exact same, you know, it's a more polite version of, frankly, the Charles Murray argument. It's like it tries to do it without racism, but ultimately there's not a lot there. And we talk about the long fight against genetic determinism, going back to Stephen Gould and the radical scientists in the 1970s and 80s.
So check that out, folks. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie, amquickie.com newsletter. It's exploding. At one point, we may go to, having it a tiered type of thing. So if you get in early, you're going to get we will definitely give you the better of the deals. Nice. So check it out. AMQuickie.com. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal leaf. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way!
unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I got to get off.
No worries. Let's I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.